Succession number 10420, Rule 22.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 22. You'd reached Quasasin Camp, Colonel.
Yes, Ilkhisasin Camp.
Ilkhisasin.
Which was where the cavalry had had a skirmish before the Battle of Terasubia. Now, the camp was about 12 square miles, I think, a very large camp, but the surrounding country on three sides was as flat as a billiard table. And nothing but desert as far as the eye could see. On the south side, about a mile and a half away, was the Sweetwater Canal, where at this particular time they were harvesting the dates, and dhows and barges were plying up and down the waterway the whole time. There would be cultivation varying from a few yards to a mile or so on both sides of this canal. So far as we were concerned, it was a tented camp, all prepared for us, in this flat part of desert part of Egypt, not far, of course, from the Suez Canal. But there was there a first-class camp commandant. We were new boys. We awoke and saw our appalling desert surroundings, he did everything to help us. Now, considering it was a desert camp, there was every form of amenity. There were excellent showers, a NAFI, a YMCA, and canteens. And they were constructing an outdoor cinema. And there were excellent cooking facilities. So the camp itself was quite first class. But there was sand all round. And we've got to remember, we were new boys, and the camp commandant did all in his power to help us get over our new boy status, you might say. Now, our program was roughly this. We got up at 6 in the morning, and we did at 6:45 mile PT. And then at 7:45 we had breakfast, and at 8:30 we started work. And at 1 o'clock we had our midday meal, our lunch, and from 1:45 to 2:15 we finished work. And at 2:30, we rested. Every chap rested in the tent, and I went to my tent and merely got stripped and put a towel around me and lay on my bed. It was so frightfully hot. And the sand would be blowing outside, and thousands of flies would be blowing inside your tent. And at 4, 4:15 or thereabouts, we had a cup of tea. And then at 4:45, we did office work, and I would go to my office and continue any office work there was. And at 6 o'clock, I'd have a shower bath, and at 6:30, I'd probably have a drink. And at 7, I wrote letters home or any business letters. And then at 8, we had our evening meal, our dinner, in the officer's mess. And at 8:45, I went back to my tent and wrote up my diary and more letters and went to bed. That was the sort of day. Now, the training one could do was extremely limited on a billiard table, you might say, a desert billiard table. But we used to go out and for route marches. I don't know whether you've ever seen a really first-class mirage, but you don't see very far in it. and everything shimmering, and everything looks very large, and you can almost see a lake in the distance. Well, we used to go out for rope marches, and on one occasion we went for 2.5 miles right out, and you couldn't see the camp because of the mirage, and we would get a private soldier or a young lance corporal to use a compass and bring us back. And we did quite a lot of compass marches. We did, in fact, on one day while we were there, do a battalion exercises, but that was really quite silly, really, because one would never do an attack right across a billiard table, as you might say. But the carriers did carrier driving, and the signalers did signal training with helio and flag and wireless and all that sort of thing. Dysentery, jippy tummy, went through the battalion, of course, like it does every British unit that arrived or then arrived in the Middle East. And a lot of chaps were smitten with that. But eventually they got over it. I, like everyone else, was also smitten with it. But the heat was intense. And the flies were awful. But considering those circumstances, it was a very good, well-run camp by the camp commandant. Any tents that were vacant, not used, had to be guarded meticulously, because it was known that the Arabs had taken, cut down 15 in 2 days. They were biggish tents. I don't know what they were classified as, but you could almost get a platoon inside, not quite as big as, perhaps as big as that. We were round about the 13th of July. We were told we were going to relieve the 1st Battalion of the Argyll and Southern Highlanders at Sidibish Barracks in Alexandria to escort prisoners and paymasters up and down the to the Western Desert.
Can I just ask you, Colonel, at this stage? Who formed the permanent staff at the camp?
Oh, it would be a completely permanent staff under the camp commandant.
Do you recall his name?
I can't recall his name now, no. But he was extremely good. There's no doubt about that.
And you were very well received.
Were well received and well looked after. There was always the trouble, you see, of a contractor. And Adobe, you went to a contractor and he would arrange anything you wanted. Like he'd find your Adobe to wash all the men's clothes, and you dealt with him. I think we did in fact start dealing direct with the Adobe, but it was fatal really. Because the Dobie had to return all the washing. And if he lost it, he was responsible. And you dealt with the contractor, who would no doubt deal with the Dobie direct. And we dealt with the contractor if the washing wasn't effective or not and didn't come up to scratch. You chased the contractor. That was the sort of way we went on. But I've no idea who the camp commandant was. And they were just starting, as I say, to construct an open-air cinema. But they hadn't got that far yet. It wasn't in
use. Did the men acclimatise quite rapidly?
Oh, yes, they began to acclimatise quite rapidly. They began to get very brown, very burnt. But it took a day or two to get over. Particularly the dysentery. I mean, I had was affected by it. Not badly. One or two days I was bad, laid off. But by the time we left, we got over it. But as I say, we were told we were going to go to City Bish Barracks at Alexandria, paymasters and prisoners of war. And we did in fact send Captain Caudwell and a very small advance party to Alexandria with a view to arranging our visit there. However, this was all cancelled very quickly, and we were then told we were going to move on the hush-hush move. We didn't know where we were going to, but we guessed that we were going to Cyprus. And we were there at this camp from about the 12th to the 23rd, about 10 days. I went one day to Ismailia to open a PRI account and company accounts and officers' accounts so that their pay could be paid in. And I went on that occasion to the United Service Club for a bathe. And in the afternoon, I went with one or two others, Erdley Wilmot, and I think I went with the CO on one occasion. And we went to the United Services Club for a bathe. And we later on in the afternoon, after lunch, we went to the French Club for a drink. And I was very much depressed at the appalling turnout and saluting of the troops that were there, that were in the streets of Ismailia. There was only one street that had European shops in, but that, I think it did improve in the end. I hope it did. And then late afternoon on that day, I went out, or we all went out, to see the Australian War Memorial that was erected, a very tall memorial that was erected on the entrance to the Suez Canal from Lake Timsa, through which the canal ran, as it were. And we went and had a look at that. It was the First World War Memorial, where the Australians stopped the Turks from getting any further into Egypt. An edict came out while we were there, I remember, warning us of gossiping and also rumors and gossiping with in and without the unit, that we had to keep everything to ourselves and certainly not gossip about with any ladies you met in Cairo or Ismailia. However, we went nowhere near Cairo at all. Apropos of shooting of the stealing of the tents, of course, we had the sentries had to shoot to kill. There's no doubt about that. I mean, there was, they didn't just say, come here. Thieving was so rampant. We were told on the, we had a conference on the, I think about the 21st of July, concerning our departure. And we took 2 days, we had to take 2 days hard rations. Hard rations was biscuits and bully beef. And it wasn't issued to the men, it was en bloc, you might say. And on the 23rd of July, to get a flying start, we moved out of the camp to the station in two groups, and we went there, I think it was It may have been the 22nd of July, and we went down to El Cassassin station and just camped, lay down by the railway station. As we had to, supposedly, to start our train journey from El Cassassin to the port, portside, at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was a dreadful camp. We had four sentries per company. There was an Arab village close to. I had an attack of gypsy tummy and ran fast to the nearby loos, which I found were Egyptian army ones, and smelt to high heaven. A sentry heard queer noises, and he nearly ran a goat through with his bayonet. And when the time came to go, we should have been trained on the 24th of July at 6 a.m. That's why we tried to get a flying start. We didn't leave till 7:30. There was a train there, but it hadn't got an engine on, and an engine had to be found to remove it so that we could get into our train. And we traveled by train to Ismailia, along the Sweetwater Canal, to Ismailia, then to Kantara, and then we arrived at Portside at 1 o'clock. Now, we had no idea what boats we were going to. We guessed we were going to Cyprus by now, but we hadn't a clue what we were going to sail in. And there we found three destroyers, the HMS Kimberley, HMS Abdil. HMS Abdil was a mine-laying destroyer and was subsequently sunk in a harbour in southern Italy, and HMS Cumberland. And we had to be on board these three destroyers, squeezed on board with these hard rations as best we could. We had to be on board at 2:10 prompt. They were going to sail at 2:10. We arrived at 1 with all our kit and baggage, and the whole lot had to be on board. Anyhow, I know I got headquarters company on board exactly at 2:10, but brigade headquarters, I think, was a few minutes late. And the Navy were quite superb. On an occasion like this, you can't imagine the jam there was on the deck. All these chaps just lying on the deck. I cannot remember now, but certainly on the return journey, which I can recall later, all the men had to take their boots off and put plimsolls on, and wear their tin hats. Whether they had to do it then on this occasion, I'm not certain. I don't think they had to. The reason they had to put plimsolls on was because there'd been a destroyer with the troops on the deck somewhere going up to Tobruk in the desert, and it had to do a very sharp turn, and the chaps had slipped off, and there'd been a bit of trouble there. But I don't think we did on this occasion. Anyhow, when the Navy heard that none of the men had had a midday meal because of the rush to get on board, they made room, and they provided the tea. And we, the quartermaster sergeants, and the, dished out some hardtack rations. They were absolutely superb, the Navy. We left on the time, 2:10, and it really was one of the most wonderful sights I've ever seen. Both these three destroyers, line abreast, was going at 27 knots across the Mediterranean, and the whole ship was shuddering as it went at this speed, with the huge bow waves, and gradually the sun set on our down in the west, and it got darker and darker and darker. There was an extremely nice, snotty young officer who took me round the boat, and there was also a very nice Lieutenant Henley, I think his name was, and he, after I'd had my evening meal and a drink with the crew, with the officers, he gave me his bunk in his cabin and said, "You go to sleep there, sir," or something like that, and he slept on the floor. And there I slept comfortably until 1 o'clock in the morning. And at 1:15 we assembled. The captain told me that he had never been into Famagusta before, Famagusta Harbour before. And I arranged that my company would all be in platoons to disembark, and the crew unloaded all the equipment and stuff. We weren't allowed to touch any of the baggage at all. Admittedly, it came precipitated off the deck onto the hard harbour of the harbour, and it was wonderful navigation. We were challenged, of course. The ship was challenged before it entered the harbour, and there was a single man on the hard with a flashlight, and he solely and alone with his flashlight guided that ship, the Kimberley that I was on, right up to the harbour wall. And it was a beautiful bit of navigation. But the Abdul came in behind. No, I think the Abdul, I'm not sure, didn't go in first. But the Cumberland was too big to get in. And everybody on the Cumberland, which was the Cheshire Regiment, had to be ferried ashore. And the reason being that the Navy wanted to be out of Famagusta and away out in the Mediterranean as if nothing had happened. And we were to be quietly got into Cyprus so that no enemy reconnaissance planes could see anything different. You've got to remember that Crete had just fallen, and that is why we were being pushed into Cyprus.
Was this a brigade move? Was it a brigade that went?
It was a brigade that went, yes. I'm not sure there wasn't another brigade. I can't remember now. But we were all ashore by 3 o'clock, 3 a.m. in the morning, all in the darkness, no lights at all, except for this one chap with his flashlight on the quayside. And we all assembled under the famous castle walls, the famous walls, and we were given tea. And we were then put into assorted vehicles under the command of an Australian mechanized cavalry unit, which was the only unit on the island at that time. And we drove to Larnaca, some 25 miles away, and we were camped under the eucalyptus trees and other trees all the way along the famous Salt Lake. And then were given a meal, I think, and the chaplain went to sleep. Now, The Salt Lake is water during the winter. The sea is allowed to come in. It's a vast area. The sea is allowed to come in, and then in the summer it's stopped and it's all dries up. And it was under the trees along this white, glaring, sunny lake that we were encamped. Now, the role, our role there was build the defences of Larnaca Aerodrome. Hundreds of Cypriots with their old-fashioned carts, oxen, and mules used to start at 5 in the morning and fill the sandbags. And they used to come trundling along to us. We'd been allotted the various parts of the defences round the aerodrome. They used to come trundling along to us, bringing sandbags. And these we built into the defences of the Larnaca Aerodrome. I've never been back to see what it's like, but I'm sure there's precious little left of all the hard work we put in. And then the Cypriots would go home and we'd finish our job for the evening. The sea was only half a mile away, and it was intensely enjoyable after a hard day's work, going down to the seashore for a bathe, which the whole battalion did. 25% of the battalion could go into Larnaca in an evening, but it was a place that was rampant with VD. It was terrible. I went into Larnaca one day to the English-speaking club. It was a wonderful old building, very old indeed, obviously, and it had a huge entrance. The gates were very, very high gates, and they were made like that to permit camels, laden camels, to go enter. And I went in there for a drink, and I met one or two Cypriots. But primarily, when one went for a bathe and then came back for one's evening meal, opposite on the far side of the Salt Lake was the Harum Umteka. Now, whilst we were there, I didn't go to see this mosque, but I did go later and see it, and while I'm talking about it, I may as well describe our visit there, which I made with about four other chap officers from Kakini Promethea, where we eventually moved. The Harum Umteka